Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today, we'll hear some highlights from last weekend's Art Splash and hear about an upcoming journalistic conference about engaging each other with civility. But first, more on the problems facing the ethanol industry and how an expanding export market could help ease the pain. The industry is still smarting from the recent move by the Environmental Protection Agency to grant waivers that allow the oil industry to use less ethanol than was originally mandated by law. Some ethanol plants, such as the Plymouth Energy Plant in Merrill, are temporarily shut down, and others are considering the same move. There was a bit of good news this week. The Brazilian government announced it would raise the quota for ethanol imports from the U.S., not subject to the country's 20% tariff. The quota essentially regulates the amount of U.S. ethanol allowed into Brazil before the tariff kicks in. Some ethanol supporters say the one-year commitment isn't meaningful, while others say the increase will help struggling Midwest corn farmers. Iowa's senior U.S. Senator, Republican Chuck Grassley, says that decision may indicate Brazil wants to start bilateral trade negotiations.
I understand that the president of Brazil has already indicated to our president that he wanted to negotiate with us. So that's an important step because you can't sit down without somebody across the table.
Brazil is removing its tariffs on imported ethanol for a year, and that could lead to it buying 25% more foreign ethanol than in the past. The move is expected to mainly impact U.S. exporters. Brazil was the top export market for the U.S. ethanol industry in 2018. David Ripplinger is a North Dakota state agricultural economist. Ripplinger says it is a bit of good news for corn farmers and ethanol producers.
It helps. I mean, it's good news. It's not huge news. I think there's other things going on in terms of Brazil that are much more exciting in the long term as they're looking to enact a low-carbon fuel standard and increase ethanol use substantially, which is going to be an opportunity for U.S. corn ethanol as they're going to be short for at least the next 5 years. So, I mean, those things are probably bigger, but of course, in terms of the small refinery waivers and everything else, and the trade war, it's really a mess. So this is like a really tiny piece of good news, but honestly, any good news is welcome.
Now, doesn't Brazil make their own fuel?
They absolutely do, yeah. And so, I mean, they produce most of the ethanol that they use, but it's really dependent on the relative price of sugar and ethanol. If sugar prices are high, they'll sell sugar as food. If those sugar prices decline relative to ethanol, they'll divert that sugar and create ethanol with it and either use it domestically or export it. And so from year to year, it all depends really on what demand is and those relative prices. And what we've actually seen over the last few years, I mean, Brazil's been our number one export market for a bit now, is that there are certain times and especially locations where U.S. corn ethanol has a home in Brazil. And so that's actually been another piece of good news. And for example, last year we exported 500 million gallons of ethanol, which again is substantially more than the 150 million gallon quota. So, I mean, you know, 150 million gallons went in tariff-free, and then 350 million gallons were subject to that 20% quota. But again, they're short. They use a lot of ethanol. They're going to use a lot more. They will produce more, but they're going to need imports, and those are almost certainly going to come from the United States.
What's your take these days, in the last few weeks, I guess, on the waivers, on the RFS waivers, and the situation it's put farmers in? Because it does seem like the ones I've talked to and the people who work in the ethanol industry in Iowa are really concerned. And people keep saying, well, we're going to talk to the president, but I haven't heard anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mess. You know, the renewable fuel standard essentially guaranteed a domestic market for biofuels and was a signal to them that, you know, investments made in new refining capacity would have some domestic home. And with the small refinery waivers, that guarantee's essentially been removed. And now we have a lot of excess capacity, and that's leading to shutdowns. And, you know, depending on where you're located, if it's your local corn ethanol refinery, that would be really bad news.
How How long can you hold on to that corn?
Oh, I mean, you can store corn for years. The question for a farmer is they need a cash flow.
Right.
And that varies. And, you know, some farmers are doing well, some are not. You know, some can, you know, can deal with. And, again, they're not going to necessarily hold on to their corn. They're going to probably sell it at a lower price. And, again, that corn has to find a home somewhere. And some of it can be the carry, just storing it into the future. You know, at the same time, you know, we're sitting here with you know, a really tough ag economy, and the question is how many farmers can deal with this for so long? And again, it's just folks on the margin, but for those who really couldn't take anything, this is really bad.
Is there anything that you think would be, obviously, you know, to deal with these waivers and sort of turn that situation around? Because by law, they're supposed to be allocating, you know, what is it, $15 billion?
Yeah, I mean, right now there's a huge political mess that the administration's gotten itself into. I think that they misunderstood, misplayed the situation. I think they thought with the E15 waiver that they had established enough goodwill with Midwestern corn farmers, and I don't think that's the case at all. And Trump's been talking for the last week about a plan to deal with the situation, and really the only option he really has would be to reallocate those gallons, but that would create a firestorm on the other side. The petroleum folks would be quite upset. Probably the big news is, depending on what Trump's plan is, if it really is a half-hearted measure, these tough times for corn ethanol are going to persist for a few years. It's going to take time with all of this excess capacity either to build domestic consumption with E15, which will take years to build up, or with exports. And again, until we kind of catch up with that on that demand side, we have all of these plants that are idle or shut down. And when that's the case, nobody's making any money.
That was David Riplinger, an agricultural economist at North Dakota State University. He was addressing the need to find new markets for ethanol in the wake of the EPA decision to issue renewable fuel waivers to oil refineries that cut back the mandated use of ethanol. Listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Many of the Democratic presidential candidates have been passing through Siouxland this summer, talking about ways to make the government fairer and more equitable. However, few of them mentioned trying to amend the Constitution and make those changes. Sandy and Cynthia Levinson are the authors of a book aimed at young readers called Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Sandy Levinson is a professor at the University of Texas Law School in Austin who has written extensively about the document's flaws. His wife, Cynthia, is an author of numerous books, many of them for young people. Sandy Levinson said he wanted to write the book because he realized how little young people know about the Constitution. He says there hasn't been a successful constitutional amendment since 1971, the 26th Amendment, which prohibits the American and federal state governments from denying someone 18 years or older the right to vote on account of their age. Sandy and Cynthia say that leaves many years with no change and no example for young voters.
That, I think, is really unfortunate because we ought to be talking about constitutional reform. I am heartened, frankly, by the fact that some of the candidates who are, you know, spending a lot of time in your state right now are talking about the need for constitutional reform. But quite frankly, I wish they were talking about it at greater length and more systematically than they are.
Do you think they're concerned that talking about it in detail will frighten some voters away? Because people were often afraid of changing that document or even discussing it.
Yes, undoubtedly that's true. And to some extent, I share that view, depending on how it's changed. But there really are some fundamental aspects that people take for granted about our government that lead to some severe inequities. For instance, while writing this book with Sandy, I'm a children's writer, he's a constitutional scholar. While writing this book with him, I came to the somewhat reluctant conclusion, reluctant only because there are so many fault lines, and many people point to what he calls gerrymandering and I call gerrymandering, or the Electoral College, as major problems. But I came to the conclusion that it's probably, for me, the Senate. The existence of the Senate and the fact that every state, regardless of its population, gets two senators as the biggest problem. And it would really take, I can understand why people would be reluctant to look at that, particularly in a state like Iowa, where you know you get some benefit from having the same number of senators as, say, Texas, where we are right now. But it that fact does help. It's dysfunctional in that it helps keep Congress from dealing with major national problems. Your state is dealing, of course, with climate change, as every state is. It's not just those on the coast that might get flooded. And the fact that that's just not a high priority in the Senate for right now, despite the fact that it's a high priority and becoming even more so for senators' constituents, is an indication that some of these scary things are going to have to be looked at.
Yeah. from my perspective, there's a vicious circle with regard to the difficulty of constitutional change, that we have a common expression: if it ain't broke, don't fix it, which makes a lot of sense. But the obverse of that is, if it can't be fixed, then let's pretend it isn't broken. And so it's just true, as a matter of fact, that it is immensely difficult, if not as a practical matter, impossible, to engage in serious constitutional reform. So that means that we have every incentive to pretend that the Constitution is really terrific in all respects and doesn't need any fixing. I compared this in another book that I wrote to the dilemma facing a woman, and it is usually a woman, in a domestic violence marriage, who believes, rightly or wrongly, that she really can't get out. And so what she does is say, well, when he's not drunk, he's actually a pretty good husband or pretty good father. And you just kind of ignore the aspects when, by no definition, is he a good husband or a good father? And if we had an easier way of changing the Constitution, then we'd have more conversations in which people would disagree. You know, some would say what I think is a bug is in fact a feature. You know, I would disagree with them, but let's argue it out and you know, see what the vote is. But we don't have those conversations now because of the quite plausible belief that nothing can be done.
Sandy and Cynthia Levinson are the authors of a book aimed at young readers called Fault Lines in the Constitution: The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Sandy Levinson is a professor at the University of Texas Law School in Austin who has written extensively about the flaws in the Constitution. His wife, Cindy, is an author of numerous books, many of them for young people.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. With election season in full swing, media coverage of politicians can often show some very uncivil behavior on both sides of the aisle. The theme of this year's Iowa State University Greeley School of Journalism and Communication Summit is civility and the role that journalists play in creating a civil discourse. It takes place this Thursday and Friday in Ames. The two-day event brings together ISU faculty and staff with industry professionals, community leaders, alumni, and students for discussions on ways to promote civility in all of our interactions. Dr. Kelly Winfrey is an assistant professor with the Greeley School of Journalism and Communication and faculty with the Leadership Studies Program for the Katz Center. Winfrey says it's important for journalists to understand their ability to either further political conversation in a civil manner or to let it continue to escalate into verbal arguments.
The faculty and the advisory council here at Greeley and some of our alums kind of shared this concern of the tone of our civic discourse, and kind of together we thought that the civility would be a great topic to focus on and hopefully contribute something to, you know, the larger society. And it wasn't, you know, it's not just focused on us as communicators, but how we interact with the public more generally. And I think that, you know, that's something that whether you're a journalist or just an average citizen, you're very aware of a lack of civility that's kind of happening in our civil discourse.
You know, and sometimes when we're covering controversial issues, which is one of your panel discussions, sometimes we don't realize as journalists that we might be sort of stirring up that incivility. Sometimes we do it by accident. Some journalists, unfortunately, sometimes do it on purpose, but it is definitely a responsibility.
Yes. Yes. I think, you know, part of it is being very aware of what the public in general might think about something. And that's not to say you shouldn't report on a topic because some people might not like it, but it might affect how you cover it. It might affect the interviews that you do or the different perspectives that you include in the story so that you're really inclusive of everyone and all the different viewpoints about an issue.
You also talk about, or we will talk about at the event, how journalists can inspire civil discourse. And this is going to be moderated, I think, by the Robert D. and Billy Ray Center from Drake University.
Yeah. That session, I think, will be very interesting because it will be very much focused on discussion of the people in attendance. So a large part of that is to have an open dialogue so that we can figure out how we can facilitate more civil discourse. So it's not just, you know, someone telling us how to do it. It's everyone there kind of brainstorming and coming together to figure out what are steps that we can take to contribute to more civility in our political discussion.
Well, probably one of the more compelling panels you're going to have has to do with the elections coming up, civility in the upcoming election cycle. And I've heard so many discussions about this since the 2016 election. Some people say, well, it's this person's fault or that person's fault. But really, maybe we're all part of this.
Yeah, you know, I think that a big issue, and I think this is one of the things we'll touch on, is that people aren't listening to each other and people are afraid to talk to each other. Some of the research that one of our keynote speakers will be talking about is about how people feel that things are very uncivil. And because of that, they don't want to engage with people they think disagree with them. And that's one of the, you know, that really kind of perpetuates that incivility because you lose the humanity of the people that maybe disagree with you. You know, I think that it used to be back in some good old day that we could talk to each other and we might disagree, but we could have a conversation and kind of understand where the other person was coming from, even if we didn't come to the same conclusions. And I think that's one of the things that's missing in our civil discourse today. And I think that's one of the things that that panel will address. Dave Price with WHO-TV here in Des Moines, his more recent book about the 2016 caucus, I think, does a good job of interviewing different, you know, different supporters of different candidates, not just Trump and Clinton, but you know, the people that supported Sanders or Bush or Cruz in the primary and where they were all coming from, and really helps you understand, you know, this is what's motivated them to these positions. Even if I disagree with them, I can understand who they are. And I think that makes a big difference.
Well, you have as a guest, you have Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller and Mike McCurry, one of the White House press secretaries, former White House press secretary, who's now working for a Wesley Theological Seminary. And they're going to be talking about getting to the truth in a civil manner when it comes to congressional investigations and hearings. And it certainly seems like in the last couple of years, that's been a big issue.
Yeah, it certainly has. You know, we've had more, I don't know if we've had more hearings, but I feel like they've been more televised and gotten more media coverage in the past few years, the Trump presidency, but some in the Obama presidency as well. And as a viewer of those, it really seems like a lot of grandstanding by both sides and not as much truth seeking. So I think this panel will talk about kind of what's happening now and maybe what we need to look for in the future. You know, we can't, as journalists, for example, we don't control what the senators ask or how they engage in the process, but we can control how we cover it and what questions we ask and push our representatives to ask. And so I think that will be a very interesting discussion and very timely because, you know, it seems like every other week there's some sort of hearing that's getting televised. And I think that panel will help us figure out how to talk about that in a way that gets to the truth and in a way that's civil and allows for differing opinions.
That was Dr. Kelly Winfrey, an assistant professor with the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication and faculty with the Leadership Studies Program for the CAT Center at Iowa State University. Winfrey is helping to organize this week's Greenlee Forum on Civility at ISU, and I will be attending that conference this Friday and coming back next week with some insights from the speakers and panel members. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. A lot of us learned Spanish or French in high school and college, but most of us sort of stuck with the language and the grammar and didn't think a lot about the larger cultural issues. Morningside College Spanish instructor Stacy Alex has co-authored a book called Mi Idioma, Mi Comunidad, Español para Bilingües, an open-access electronic textbook for heritage language learners of Spanish that centers on students' experiences with language, identity, and belonging in the Midwest. Alex says there are already a lot of great books for heritage language learners, but many are more advanced. This one is on an entry level when it comes to grammar. Alex says that's because she wanted the book to be accessible for everyone.
Perhaps they feel comfortable to different extents speaking, but they haven't had a chance to develop necessarily all of the writing skills or, but we also need to work on speaking skills too, depending on how much exposure students have had, how many experiences they've been able to have.
So what about your family? What level do you think your family is at looking at this continuum of language skills?
You know, between my niece and my nephew and my son, you know, they're all heritage learners, but there are different levels of who's more proficient in English and who's more proficient in Spanish, and those actually change over time. So they go back and forth quite a bit.
What I like about this is that in terms of, you know, learning and different learning styles, that as a student who's using it, you can go in and it's so interactive. You can use a podcast, you can use music, you can use any number of different areas of this to learn.
Student choice is really important to us and incorporating that. And that was one of the suggestions we got actually was, maybe students don't need to all do the same project at the end of every module. And so we made that recommendation in there's a part that says how to use this book. And we said, you know, if you want to add even more choice, go ahead and offer some of those other extension activities as alternative projects or have, you know, three different options for that final project. So yeah, I'm glad you saw that we're proud of that too.
Because I find that, you know, if you engage in especially adult learning, if you can find that area where you have a specific interest, it's so much more, I think, motivating because it's different being grown up and learning, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. And in all levels of learning, we just really try to approach the classroom in a way that recognizes students' backgrounds as assets, right? I feel like there's this kind of a history in language teaching in which teachers have kind of looked at what students bring linguistically as needing to be replaced, right? And I've even heard teachers say things like, well, you know, we don't want them to use kitchen Spanish in the classroom. And I just think that's really too bad, right, to look at it as a negative rather than a positive, right? Instead of looking at students' language experiences as something to be, you know, improved upon or replaced, rather let's look at what students bring with them and what they can share with us and teach us, right? Because students are teachers as well, right? We can all contribute to the learning environment.
You know, it just really seems like you've had a broad range of teaching experiences and cultural experiences. So I would assume that would really affect how you look at a book like this and how you would approach it.
Yeah, all of those experiences definitely informed how I approach putting the book together with my co-author. She also had experience in K-12. And so both of us were really invested in using the best pedagogical practices possible. And both of us have a background in communicative teaching, an approach to language teaching. So making sure that it's student-centered, right, rather than, you know, typically the teacher stands up at the front of the class and you know, spends a lot of time talking or lecturing, but rather kind of turning that around and putting a lot of the, asking students to take a real stake in their learning and spending more time speaking than anything else, right? Because my experience in high school was, you know, I loved my teacher, but my very first job ever, I had a coworker who was a recent Mexican immigrant, and I was asked to translate for him, for my boss, or I shouldn't say translate, interpret is the correct word. I was asked to interpret, you know, and I opened my mouth and nothing came out. And that was just a really shocking moment for me, you know, personally, in terms of how I saw language learning, and that I wanted to make it more real world, right? Because when you get out in the real world, you find out that, you know, the people you want to speak to don't know their half of the script. Do you know what I mean? You know, when you do those scripts and you fill them out in your textbook, well, they don't have the other part to know how they're supposed to react. So moving to a direction in which we have more kind of real world situations, real world texts, but then even beyond text, like you said, videos, podcasts, right? Getting real, lots of diverse resources. So that students can appreciate the diversity of language and culture, right? There is no one Spanish language. There is no one Spanish-speaking culture. There are just so many, and we just have to be ready to be flexible and keep learning.
That was Stacy Alex, the co-author of the book Mi Idioma, Mi Comunidad, Español Par Bilingües. Alex is an instructor of Spanish at Morningside College and has taught Spanish and ESL here in the U.S. and in Latin America. The book is an open-access, interactive ebook aimed at heritage language learners of Spanish. It is free and available to be used by all educators and students. Well, language and culture often separate us, but the Mary Trelia Community House in Sioux City strives to bring people together. The house opened in 1921 to serve the needs of Siouxland's immigrant children and families. This weekend, the organization is opening its community garden for an afternoon of culture and conversations. Mary Day is a member of the board of directors at Mary Trelia. She talked to Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer about the event, which is open to the public.
Well, this is a second year in a row that a group of people from Mary Trelia Community House have decided to try and bring the community together for something other than services. Mary Trelia is a community house that provides many services like ELL classes and citizenship classes, an immigration lawyer, and translations and all this kind of stuff for our immigrant community. But to bring them together for more cultural events that are just, you know, enjoyable and an opportunity for us to sit down and talk, an opportunity to experience other cultural happenings. And so this one is called Culture and Conversations, and it's on Sunday, September 8th, 2 to 4. In our beautiful community garden, which is behind the building on 9th and Jennings, we will have women, Eritrean women, roasting coffee. They come from Ethiopia, and coffee comes from Ethiopia. We will also have a Guatemalan woman roasting Guatemalan coffee. And then we'll have some Pakistani chai being made for us to enjoy, some Hispanic hibiscus waters to drink, and some light snacks to go with this, because you never have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea without some snack, huh? And in the ceremonies of these roasting events, many of them offer you 3 cups of coffee in events. So you see some of the beans being roasted, and then you get to take in the odor of those roasted beans, and then you receive a cup of coffee and something to eat, and then you receive a second cup of coffee and a third cup of coffee, not huge mugs like we're used to, but small demi-tasse coffees. And it's a ceremony to do this, so it also takes time. It's not a thing that you come to and pick up a cup of coffee and run. It's an event to come through and have some conversations, ask some questions about why this culture does that. So we have Hispanic cultures, Guatemalan cultures, Ethiopian cultures, both chai and coffee, and Pakistani. So it's an event to just come and enjoy. Last year we had a number of people come and they found it to be enjoyable. So we're going to try and make this into a yearly event.
Especially for some cultures, like you said, coffee really does open up those conversations. It's a way to bond. It's a way that people really honor the other people in their lives.
Absolutely. And it's a way to bring a guest into your home. I mean, I don't think there's hardly any of us who, if someone comes to our house, we don't offer them something to drink.
There's usually a pot of coffee brewing.
There's usually a pot of coffee.
And depending on what time of day, is it decaf or not?
Right. And so it's a normal thing. But coffee originated in Ethiopia. And then the South American countries provide us a lot of coffee as well, too. We don't have so much in our own land here. So we drink it regularly. But to know the ceremonies that began with it and come over to the States with the people that are coming from those countries is just an enjoyable afternoon.
And also, as you said, Mary, Trailia helps people who are coming from other countries to Siouxland.
This is right. We do. And we're hoping that in time, their lives and the lives of the people, of those of us who have been here for some time, will start to intersect more often, and that we will find ways of being really comfortable with one another and bonding and getting to know one another as friends.
And that's what this event will do.
That's right.
The culture and conversations.
Just encourage everyone to come. It's a free event because it's a cultural event. It's not a service event. It's a cultural event. So come and take a few hours and watch a ceremony and enjoy some conversations and enjoy the way they drink coffee or tea.
That's Mary Day. The Mary J. Trailia House was originally called the Sioux City Community House. It was renamed the Mary J. Trailia House in 1956 to honor Mary J. Trailia, who was a member of the All-American Ladies Baseball League, and returned to Sioux City to dedicate her life to helping immigrants in Sioux City. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Young people in the Siouxland area will soon have a new place to experience art. Siouxland Public Media's Mae McFarlane reports on a new exhibit at a familiar site.
The Sioux City Art Center has been a staple in Siouxland for decades now and is a special place for many people. Going on its 81st year of operation, the Art Center is planning new ways to use the gallery space to make the center even more family-friendly. Al Harris-Fernandez is the director of the Sioux City Art Center and has been working closely with the Junior League the past several years, getting the hands-on gallery updated.
Well, there's a number of new ones, and I've been working with members of the Junior League committee, and we reviewed different possibilities for new interactive stations, and there will be a number of new stations.
Located on the first floor of the Art Center, the new hands-on gallery will feature several new exhibits, as well as some favorites from the original hands-on gallery space. Each exhibit is family-focused and can be used by all ages. Someone Al has been working closely with is Rhonda Henry, the chairman of the Junior League Hands-On Gallery Project, to come up with ideas for the space and how the gallery should be used.
We are keeping the Lego Center and the Magnet Wall, which were two, you know, very popular exhibits with the old gallery. But I've got to say, I'm super excited about some of the new exhibits we're doing. There's a couple that I think, you know, kids are just going to love. We have some of it, you know, might even be going somewhat back to retro, but we have this light table that's pretty cool, and it's going to be where a picture is going to appear on a screen, and along with a timer, and the kids are supposed to have to try and match the picture, if they'd like, with the light bright with the timer. And again, they can, you know, they can do that, or they can just simply do their own pictures with the pegs and the light bright table, but that'll be fun. It'll be interactive and fun.
A main focus of the Art Center has been to enhance art education in Siouxland and to create an interesting way for children to get involved in the arts. The new hands-on gallery is a tactile art experience that will allow children to experiment and create with different mediums.
It would just be fresh and exciting for the kids to come in and have something new, you know, to touch and feel, and the exhibits to do. As you know, the Art Center is free and open to the public, and so it just gives an opportunity for children of all ages, you know, to come in, because without having to pay an admission fee, and just experience arts of all different kinds, you know, to be able to touch, feel, and just be able to use their abilities and artistic things that they wouldn't maybe necessarily otherwise have opportunities to do. And so it just to enhance the arts in the Siouxland area, especially with kids.
The Junior League has been a supporter of the Art Center since the beginning. Now, 81 years later, they are still in collaboration.
When the Junior League has had a collaboration with the Art Center for many, many years, they were part of the group that actually raised funds to create the first home for the Sioux City Art Center back in 1938.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's a long history. They've been involved in a lot of projects and developed some programs that we continue to keep on. Keep doing, like the Artworks program. This was an opportunity for the Junior League to get involved with the hands-on gallery again, and because we're repurposing different parts of the building, this is where the new hands-on gallery will be.
Okay.
And they made a commitment to raise money to update all the stations.
The Junior League of Sioux City has been the primary source of funds and designs for the new hands-on gallery. An $80,000 donation from the Junior League, as well as more support from local Siouxland businesses, is how we, as a community, are able to enjoy the Art Center.
A fundraising drive within the Junior League. So not only the Junior League itself, but we've asked our members to add 100 hands. So for $100, they get their hands on a little, or we'll have them in the Art Center on a hand decorated. And we're hoping to raise $10,000 that way as well. And we're also, we're up to about $5,500. So if anybody else would like to contribute $100 to have their hand put on the wall, we're still looking for donations to that too.
How would someone do that?
They can contact the Art Center and let them know that they are interested in joining the 100 Hands fundraiser for the Junior League Art Center, or the Junior League Hands-On Gallery at the Art Center.
The new Hands-On Gallery has been a 3-year process now, and it is finally time for it to be open to the public. Al has been working on this collaboration with the Junior League and is very excited to see the end result.
No, I'm just really happy to be working with the Junior League. They're doing a terrific job, and I'm sure they'll be very excited to, when we open it in September sometime, we'll do a big grand opening on September 28th for everything that we've done, but we'll also have some other events specifically focused on the hands-on gallery.
This new hands-on experience may inspire the next generation of local Sioux City artists, or even the next Picasso. Check the Art Center's website for hours of operation, classes, and what new exhibits will be coming. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Mae McFarlane.
You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, speaking of art, on the final afternoon of Art Splash on Sunday, we caught up with the development coordinator for the Art Center, Erin Weber-Driesen. She's in charge of the annual event. She says, personally, Art Splash has come full circle in her life.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I've gone to, I think, pretty much every Art Splash ever since it started in 1994. And, you know, times have changed for me since that time. I was in high school in 1994. What you look for when you're in high school is different than when you have children. And I started bringing my children, and you can hear children in the background right now, which was appropriately timed. Thank you, little children. But, you know, I started bringing my kids to Art Splash, and so we started doing children's activities, and it was at the riverfront. And we would do art activities, and we would play on the inflatable slides, and we would watch the entertainment at the children's stage and listen to the storytellers, and we would go to the main stage entertainment and look at all the beautiful art. And I would always buy, because of the way that it would fall in my calendar year, I would always buy Christmas gifts for my family. I would always make sure that I had gifts for my sister, who her birthday is in October. And so it was my way of getting something unique for my family. So it's always been a part of my life. Then, as my life changed and I was staying home with my kids, I had a job then after a little while working for my church. I had this weird skill set that made me perfect for the Art Center. I started working for the Art Center, and I've had the incredible opportunity to be in charge of this project. Art Splash is so near and dear to my heart personally, and being able to put it on for another generation of people who have small kids, bringing them to the festival, and letting them take advantage of the art projects and helping out nonprofit organizations realize their dreams. It is an incredible honor to do this. This is my eighth year. And every year, it is so much work. And at the end of it, we look back as a staff and we think, we did it. It's done, and we're so proud of being able to do this as staff of the Art Center and as volunteers for Art Splash and present something of real quality for the families of Siouxland.
Aaron talked about the weather during this year's festival. Rain on Saturday kept the crowds away.
It was a new adventure. I had never, in my 8 years organizing Art Splash, I had never had a morning like that where we had just steady rain. So I just kept thinking to myself, you know what? I'm looking around at people in their rain gear and with umbrellas, and they're still at the festival and they're still buying art. And we had several artists that said, I still had a great morning. I still had a great Saturday in spite of the weather. And as the rain abated and we had people come out and take advantage of all of the activities and come and buy art, we were just extremely grateful for the day. And I think that attitude is everything as you come into something like that. I got on the radios and I sang for the steering committee and our staff. I don't know if they were particularly grateful for that, but, you know, they get what they get and they don't throw a fit. We have a beautiful Sunday and we have fantastic crowds today. I don't think that we could ask for a better festival.
That's Aaron Weber-Driesen with the Sioux City Arts Center talking about this year's Art Splash. Thousands of people gathered at Riverside Park for Art Splash, and after a slower start Saturday because of that rainy weather, Sunday brought out a huge crowd, and about a dozen people shared their thoughts on this annual Sioux City Festival.
My name is Beth Harms, and I am from Sioux City. I think Art Splash is one of the fun times that we have in Sioux City. It gives us an opportunity to see a wide selection of art. The music's always fun. And it's good to see people from different parts of the country coming in with their expressions of self shown through their art.
My name is Chris Jensen, and I'm from Sioux City. And I think Art Splash is like Saturday in the Park and a couple other events around Sioux City. Very special, unique, and look forward to it every year.
My favorite thing about Art Splash is just all the people that come out to support the arts in our community. I think this is a wonderful event where you see people actually creating the art. You get to talk to the artists. You get to see some of the artists creating right in their own booths, and it's wonderful. Donna Behrens, and I live in Sioux City, Iowa.
My name is Jacob Van Wyk. I am from Ireton near Sioux Center, where I've taught at Dort University for 25 years. And I'm a potter. I do a lot of things, but I bring pots to the show here.
So you're going to do the smaller cup. Oh, you're still deciding. I'm still selling you on other
she's
products.
She's got one over there. She's already picked out.
And this is just a fantastic venue. I love the park. There are a lot of artists here, so people come out mostly for the art. There are a lot of extra things, but that's what I enjoy about this show, because its emphasis is on the art.
My name is Suzanne Brummer, and I'm from Denison, Iowa. It's my first time. The weather's nice. A lot of friendly, nice people, of course. About anything you'd want.
My name is Katie. I am 10 years old. I'm from Sioux City, Iowa, and I like looking at the art, and I also like the activities that the kids can do, too. I am Lily. I am 10 years old, and I am from Sioux City, Iowa, and I really like magnets in one of the booths because I think they're handcrafted, and I really like the activities here.
I'm Andrea Porter. I'm the naturalist for Monona County Conservation down in Ottawa, Iowa. And I'm part of Sierra Club, and today we're at Art Splash talking about flora and fauna of the prairie. I have some live animals. I have a painted turtle, her name's Frankie, and then I have a fox snake that is 3 feet long.
I'm Lynn Decker, and what I think about Art Splash, I'm from South Sioux City. We have been coming every year since they started. We absolutely love this. It's a highlight of our summer, actually. We'd love to go ahead and see all the artists that come through and buy some of their things. But we especially come for the grandchildren so that they can play.
Can I get your name?
Allie.
And how old are you?
9.
And where are you from?
Sioux City. I like Art Splash.
And what do you like about Art Splash?
Rock climbing.
And what other things do you like about Art Splash?
Art.
Do you have a special piece of art that you've liked?
Frisbee.
Oh, the spinning frisbees. Those are nice, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have quite a few of those at home?
Yeah.
How old were you when you first came to Art Splash, do you think?
Since I was in a stroller.
Robert Rivers. I'm from Naples, Florida. Second year at Art Splash. I'm in the business of selling barbecue, so hey, we look for crowds.
Do you plan to come back next year?
I do plan to come back next year and take first. I took third, second, so next year will be first.
You won second place for food at Art Splash.
Yes. Yep. So, hey, keep trying.
Valerie, I live in Sioux City in the Morningside area. I'd like to come here to bring my kids for the activities that they have for them. Brought Jocelyn, Dante, Griffin, and my niece Amaya. So far they've made some bumblebees out of aluminum cans. They painted on the car over here.
Hi, my name is Griffin, and I think Art Splash is the best place I've ever been to.
My name is Luke Colley. I'm the lead singer of The Ruralist, and we played today. I think Art Splash is great. It's a wonderful opportunity for a community to celebrate the art that's happening in the community, and it's super kid-friendly, and it's a beautiful day, and what's not for that?
Many people we talk to say they already can't wait for next year's Art Splash. Thanks to everyone who stopped by our Siouxland public media booth at the Engage the Community section of Art Splash for a look at some of the people interviewed by Siouxland public media for this special segment. Go to our website, kwit.org, and look for Art Splash 2019. And that's it for this edition of The Exchange. Thanks to Sheila Brummer and everyone who helped out. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.